A quick note before we get started today. This podcast is going out on April 16th, which is my birthday, my 39th birthday, if you're listening to this in 2024. And this day also marks the beginning of pre-sales for my new book, How to Turn 39, which is not specifically about turning age 39. It is about aging and growing older in general. And it's for people of all ages, younger, older, people who are around the same elder millennial age as I am. Whatever your age, this book is for anyone who wants to age and grow older and grow as people more intentionally. And if you're curious to check it out, you can find a link to this book in the show notes of today's episode. And that link will take you to a collection of links to different platforms so you can choose your favorite book purveyor to pre-order a copy if you'd like to. And by pre-ordering a copy of this book, you are poking the relevant algorithms and saying, hey, take a look at this book, maybe show it to other people. And that is incredibly helpful for indie authors such as myself, who don't have the backing of a major publisher. We are at a significant disadvantage when it comes to the online marketplace for books. So if you decide to pre-order or order the book once it goes live, you are not only directly helping to support me financially and supporting everything I do, including Let's Know Things, you are also telling these entities that determine who sees what, hey, check this out. You might want to show this person's work to more people. So a huge thanks in advance if you decide to do so, if you decide to check this out and maybe help out more directly in that regard. Now, all that said, let's get to the actual show. There is a concept in international law, diplomatic immunity, that says, in essence, certain government officials should be immune from the laws of foreign countries, including those within which they're operating. This is a very old concept, based on similar rights that were granted to envoys and messengers back in the oldest documented periods of human civilization. The idea is that if different cultures, whether organized into tribes or kingdoms or nation-states, are going to be able to deal with each other, they need to maintain open and reliable means of communication. Thus, the folks tasked with carrying messages between leaders of these different groups would need to be fairly confident that they wouldn't be hassled or attacked or prosecuted by the people they were bringing those messages to and whose messages they were then bringing back to their own leaders. Such representatives have at times been imprisoned or killed by their hosts, but this is relatively rare, because any governing body that treated ambassadors from other cultures in this way would have trouble dealing with anyone else outside their current legal relationship sway, and that would in turn mean less trade, less reliable peace, and less opportunity to generally cross-pollinate with cultures they might benefit from cross-pollinating with. As a general rule, at least in the modern iteration of diplomatic immunity, folks operating under the auspices of this policy can still be punished for their misdeeds. It's just that they will generally be declared persona non grata, expelled from the country where they did something wrong, rather than punished under the country's laws like a citizen of that country would be. In some rare instances, a country hosting a misbehaving or criminal ambassador or other diplomat might ask that person's home country, that government, to waive their immunity, basically saying, look, this person killed someone or got drunk and drove recklessly through our capital city's downtown. We would like to try them in our courts. And it may be that the government running that misbehaving person's home country says, okay, yeah, that's messed up, you go ahead. But usually, even if that person has done something truly reprehensible, they will instead say, no, sorry, we will pull them back, and they won't be allowed to return to your country or to serve as an ambassador anywhere else, because they've shown themselves to be unreliable, and we might even try them in a court here, in their home country, but we cannot allow our people, no matter what they do, to fall under the legal jurisdiction of some other nation, because that would set a bad precedent, and it may make people wary of working for us in this or other capacities in the future. Surely you understand. And they would understand, because they would typically do the same thing for their own people. There are tiers of diplomatic immunity, depending on the seniority of the diplomat or other representative in question, and the Congress of Vienna in the early 1800s charted out the basis for how these things work, in much detail, formalizing a lot of what was already in the ether back then, and creating an outline that was then further formalized in 1961's Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, which has been almost universally ratified and respected, though of course there's been a lot of gray area in terms of what harassment of a representative, which is a no-no according to this convention, entails, and to what degree it can be proven, and thus punished, if violated. We saw a lot of gray area utility during the height of the Cold War, in particular, in part because many diplomats were moonlighting as spies, which is still true today, though it was even more overt and worrisome to their host countries back then. So harassment, kidnappings, even assassinations of diplomats were more common then than today, though they were still almost universally done covertly, so that no one seemed to be violating these nearly universally accepted terms. What I'd like to talk about today is another type of legal immunity, in this case, presidential immunity, in the U.S., and why this type of immunity is at the center of former U.S. President Trump's ongoing legal cases. You're listening to Let's Know Things. I'm Colin Wright. Learn more about Let's Know Things, subscribe to receive free email updates, and or become a supporter to receive monthly bonus episodes at letsknowthings.com. In the United States, many politicians and high-level appointees enjoy some of the immunity-related privileges in their own country that diplomats of various stripes have traditionally enjoyed elsewhere. Most of these figures are only protected by this immunity under very specific circumstances, though, not universally. Judges, while doing court-related judge work, for instance, have absolute civil immunity. So a judge who falls afoul of the law in the course of their duty as a judge doing judge things will tend to get away with whatever it is they did wrong, though this will not generally apply to non-judge things they do during the same period. So a judge would have trouble arguing that they should get off with a warning for murdering someone because they happened to kill that person while they were on their lunch break, but they would likely be okay if they accidentally ruled in a way that exceeded their jurisdiction, even if their having done so caused all sorts of secondary problems. Similarly, and also within the U.S. court system, a prosecutor cannot be sued for withholding evidence, even if their having done so leads to a wrongful conviction, which would be a bad thing that happened as a result of their actions. But because they acted while performing their protected duty, they will almost certainly be okay from a legal standpoint, even if not always a moral one. These are not rules novel to the U.S. system of governance. Most of them were borrowed from earlier forms of the same, and a lot of the U.S.'s version of these immunity rules are derived from those that exist within the British parliamentary system, where parliamentarians cannot be prosecuted for things they say while in parliament, and the same is true for politicians while engaged in their work on the floor of the U.S. House and Senate. Interestingly, though, while the U.S. Constitution provides that kind of legislative immunity to Congress people, it does not grant the same or anything similar to the president. And this was apparently a hotly debated topic back in the Constitution writing days, as those who set up the rules of the land were aware that it might be beneficial to allow folks at the top some legal leeway so they don't make executive decisions based on whether or not they might be sued or otherwise punished for those decisions. But at the same time, they really did not want another king or similarly authoritarian ruler to step into office and then get away with murder, perhaps literally. So the Constitution does not give the President of the United States the same immunity as other members of government, but a slew of cases in the 19th and 20th centuries found, in general, that if the President or members of the President's cabinet take actions that are, quote, more or less, end quote, within the scope of their duties, they should be granted absolute immunity, protecting them from lawsuits and legal punishments. A court case against President Nixon in the 1970s made that previously somewhat vague and general legal trend more formal, at first triggering a bunch of lawsuits against him and his people, but then a 1982 Supreme Court decision said, in essence, that former or current presidents are immune from lawsuits related to anything that falls within the, quote, outer perimeter, end quote, of their duties, due to the president's, quote, unique status under the Constitution, end quote. This legal precedent was tested in the mid-1990s when then-President Bill Clinton was sued for sexual harassment during his days as governor of Arkansas, and a lower court, then the Supreme Court, both affirmed that presidential immunity does not protect the president from things they did before taking that highest government office. As a result of all that, today we have a legal context in which the president is kind of granted some immunity for some things they do while in office, but the delineation between protected and not protected is fuzzy. And there's a whole lot of theory on this matter, but less in the way of actual court precedent that establishes confident footing for anyone stepping into this corner of the legal world. All of which is newly relevant in 2024, because former U.S. President Trump is currently being prosecuted for all sorts of things in several different jurisdictions. And part of his legal strategy is based on a sort of Hail Mary play that's made its way to the Supreme Court, and which is premised on the concept of presidential immunity. But before we get to that case, let's talk real quick about the other cases that are currently in progress, all of which that bigger Supreme Court case may influence, depending on how it turns out. Beginning this week, as of the day this episode goes live, the week of April 15th, 2024, Trump is scheduled to be in court 4 days a week for the next 6 to 8 weeks, facing 34 criminal charges related to falsifying business records in order to get payoff money to Stormy Daniels, allegedly to cover up an affair they had, which he did not want becoming public while he was running for his first term in office. Tentatively beginning in late May of 2024, Trump will face 40 criminal charges in Florida for allegedly mishandling sensitive documents and his alleged conspiracy to keep those documents even after the government demanded them back, a federal case in which Trump faces 4 criminal charges related to his alleged effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election results, was originally meant to begin the first half of this year, but it's looking increasingly likely it won't occur until after the November presidential election, as the judge overseeing the case has postponed it until after the Supreme Court makes their decision about presidential immunity, though there's a chance it could start as early as August, despite that delay. And Trump faces 10 criminal charges for the same general collection of alleged efforts to overturn the 2020 election in Georgia, alongside 18 alleged co-conspirators. That trial has a proposed start date of August 5th, but that would be tricky, as it would mean the trial could run through Election Day, which would be awkward and would likely complicate things further in a bunch of different ways. Trump has also dealt with a flurry of recent civil, so non-criminal, no jail time possible, just fines, lawsuits, including one related to sexual assault and his defamation of the person he sexually assaulted, which led to a big payout recently, and another in New York related to his misrepresentation of the value of his real estate holdings in the state, which led to an even bigger fine, but which is currently being appealed. There's another federal civil case that's ongoing, Thompson v. Trump, which is related to the attack on the U.S. Capitol by Trump's fans on January 6, 2021, and that is especially relevant here because already the judge in that case ruled that Trump's presidential immunity does not shield him from this lawsuit, and an appeals judge ruled the same. There is now a Supreme Court case, which I mentioned earlier, that consolidates 3 separate civil lawsuits into just one, Trump v. United States. And this case asks, in essence, whether Trump should be protected from these lawsuits by presidential immunity, that same immunity that was upheld in many cases in recent memory, though in different contexts. The reason this Supreme Court case is so fundamental here is that it could impact many or all of those other cases, plus others that might arise related to Trump's actions in the future, as it would give him a sort of legal whammy on just about anything he could argue was done within the purview of his role as president. Thus, he could argue that he was not trying to overturn the 2020 election that he lost. He was looking into what he considered to be legitimate election irregularities as part of his duty as president. And if some other things happened as a result of that effort, like his supporters breaking into the Capitol building, he should be protected from that under the auspices of this immunity. Those two D.C. court judges that earlier ruled Trump was not protected by presidential immunity said that it is in the public interest to hold presidents accountable for their actions, because not doing so would leave anyone who holds that office, quote, unbounded authority to commit crimes, end quote. They determined that it was worth the possibility that a president might make some executive decisions from a perspective of worrying about later lawsuits if it would prevent the creation of a political office from which someone could legally get away with any crime they chose to commit, including but not limited to, theoretically at least, assassinating their political rivals. The big question now is how the Supreme Court will decide on this matter. Some people are predicting that the current court, which is heavily slanted toward conservative justices, will be more likely to find in Trump's favor, though they've defied those expectations several times in recent years, in some cases seeming to take advantage of their current 5 or 6, depending on how you measure, versus 3 conservative to liberal composition in order to get a bunch of Republican priorities accomplished, like overturning Roe v. Wade, which protected the right to an abortion at the federal level in the United States. But in other cases, they've made what seem to be more objective rulings, defying assumptions made based on those ideological leanings. So there's no way to know for certain one way or the other on this right now. We will likely find out, though, sometime in May or June, as the court will begin considering these claims on April 25th of this year, and it's expected they will have their ruling sometime in those subsequent 2 months. Until then, though, some of these other cases are a bit up in the air, as the granting of enhanced immunity could make Trump's current and potential future cases a slam dunk for his defense team, while a ruling in favor of the contemporary fuzzy standard, or one that weakens that standard, at least for his specific context, would deny him that potentiality. That said, Trump's defense team seems to have also been making use of the abundant delay tactics that are available within the U.S. justice system, and there's a chance that if he delays long enough, and then wins another term as president in November, that would allow him, when he steps back into office early next year, to either pardon himself or order someone in his government to get rid of the charges against him, which is part of why the prosecutors working opposite him have been politely but firmly asking the judges in charge of these cases to pick up the pace, because there is a looming possibility that even if the courts decide against Trump in some key cases, he could still get off scot-free because of that other apparent loophole in the system that would allow a sitting president to get away with just about anything, though in this case because of a different, in practice, immunity-granting mechanism rather than a formal finding that presidential immunity de facto protects whoever sits in that office. So in lieu of a typical book recommendation today, as I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, I've got a new book coming out. It actually releases on May 16th, 1 month after my birthday, but it is available for pre-sale beginning today, April 16th. So if you have any interest in the concept of aging and how we might grow older with more intention, how we might do it better, consider pre-ordering a copy of How to Turn 39, which is the title of that new book. That's a great way to support me and my work, including this show, and it's an excellent way, especially if you pre-order, to get the book in front of Amazon and all the other platforms' algorithms to let them know that this is something they should show to other people as well. A great big thanks in advance if you decide to pick up a copy of that book, and I will be back with a more typical book recommendation in next week's episode. You can subscribe to receive email updates, find show notes, and other such content, and support this show financially, receiving additional bonus episodes as a thank you at letsknowthings.com, Learn more about me and my work at Colin.io. Subscribe to my other news-focused podcast, One Sentence News, wherever you get your pods, or at onesentencenews.com. And say howdy on social media. I'm at Colin is my name on Instagram and Twitter, and Colin Wright on Facebook and YouTube. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Colin Wright, and I'll talk to you again next week.